Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement by Japanese authorities that the Fukushima nuclear disaster has released radiation to the maximum on the scale to level 7, the same as Chernobyl. Dr. Arjan Makajani, the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, joins us to assess the upgraded danger posed to Japan and its people. Then we'll examine the role of the African Union in their failed attempt to mediate an end to the fighting in Libya. The Deputy Director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Program, Richard Downey, joins us to discuss this and broader issues affecting the African continent. Then finally, we'll look into ties between Ivory Coast's recently deposed dictator Laurent Gbagbo and the Christian right. Justin Elliott, a reporter for Salon.com who broke this story, now featured in today's New York Times, joins us to assess the role of U.S. senators and right-wing media figures, among other Christian conservatives, in supporting reactionary regimes in Africa. Let's now turn to the fallout from the nuclear disaster in Japan. Joining me now is Dr. Arjan Makajani, who is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. He holds a PhD in engineering, specializing in nuclear fusion from the University of California at Berkeley. He has spent the last decades working to promote an economy based on completely renewable energy. His books include Nuclear Wastelands, Mending the Ozone Hole, and, most recently, Carbon-Free and Nuclear-Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arjan Makajani.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Clearly, the upgrading of this nuclear disaster to level 7 equal to Chernobyl is bad news. But of course, it's apparently taken a month for them to announce this information. So could there be worse news in the pipeline yet to be presented?
This problem with 3 reactors and 4 spent fuel pool is far from being under control. The emissions appear to be lower now than they have been in weeks past, but it's not at all clear that will continue. The potential for releases from the spent fuel pools and possibly the reactors is still significant, even though there have been huge releases so far. I think the Japanese Safety Agency, as well as the company, have been living in something of a fantasy world and classifying this as level 5 so far at the level of Three Mile Island, which had no detectable contamination of cesium and other similar radionuclides far away from the plant, whereas we've had global fallout from Fukushima for 3 weeks or more than 3 weeks, nearly from the beginning, and it has been detected in the monitoring stations throughout the world. I issued a press release 3 weeks ago, I think, saying that level 5 was a fantasy. So, and these are not, this is not a numerological exercise. It's how vigorously you're going to respond, how vigorously you're going to measure, how vigorously you're going to protect the public, not only in Japan, but also around the world. I mean, Japan's neighbors are rightly concerned at the conduct of the authorities in this matter, and I think they haven't done too well. I haven't been very critical in the past, but given the scale of the disaster and the tsunami and the earthquake, but it's very aggravating to watch them playing around with these numbers and pretending it was a level 5 for more than a month or a month.
And Dr. Arjan Makajani, you just mentioned the spent fuel pond in Reactor Building 4. Apparently, there is still concern over that. And if that were to go have criticality, that could release 250 tons of material that are sitting in that pond. So when you say it's not over, it's certainly not over if that's still a possibility.
Well, they've already had a hydrogen explosion there, so far as we can see. It's suspected anyway. They've probably had a fire there. They've had enough of an explosion that it has destroyed a good bit of the top of the reactor building, and that's why there's been so much radiation leaking from there. The amount of radioactivity in spent fuel pool number 4 is very much larger than the others, not only because there's more spent fuel, but because the whole reactor core from the reactor had been unloaded into the spent fuel pool because the reactor was down for maintenance. And so it has got short-lived radionuclides like iodine, which deposit on grass and get into the milk and so on. And besides accidental criticalities, this reactor pool number 4, so far as I can tell, you know, this is a fog of the nuclear crisis, so I have to put that caveat, is by far the worst spent fuel pool problem that has existed in nuclear power plant history, period. By itself, it should have been classified as something more than 5.
And, of course, yesterday there was yet another aftershock that shut down the cooling system at the plant for almost an hour. So, again, it seems that we don't really have a fix on how much the Japanese authorities are on top of this situation, Dr. Ajahn Makajani. There is, of course, this Amakadari concept in Japan, which we would refer to here in the United States as the revolving door, often in reference to the Pentagon, where generals retire and then go into the military-industrial complex. But it's quite common in Japan for this Amakadari revolving door of government bureaucrats going into business. And do you think that that's a factor in the paucity of information that both the Japanese government and TEPCO, Tokyo Power, have provided from day one?
I haven't researched the revolving door in Japan. You know, it's an open secret in Washington, not only in the Pentagon, but in a lot of other domains, including the nuclear domain. But it wouldn't surprise me, because the government and the regulators and the industry in Japan are far too cozy. They've allowed them to get away with too much. They've allowed them to build these reactors in the first place in a known extremely high earthquake and tsunami zone. The nuclear industry in Japan hasn't been paying attention, from what I can tell, to advances in seismic and tsunami science in terms of estimating what they can do and in terms of design and protection. So, you know, I think the performance overall, you know, I really empathize with the people over there and how much they're suffering, and they have, the government has been in a very difficult situation, but I have to say the nuclear authorities in the company and the safety agency have not helped by pretending that this is something akin to Three Mile Island. It's never been from day one.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Ajahn Makajani, who is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. So a spokesman for Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, who run the Fukushima plant, suggested that this could even end up being worse than Chernobyl. But that in announcing the level 7 on the International Nuclear and Radiological Event Scale, the INES scale, now putting it on a par with Chernobyl. But I think it's worth noting here that the measurement that we're talking about represents becquerels, I guess, or terabecquerels. Yeah. And that's not necessarily the best measurement, as opposed to sieverts, right, that measure the medical impact of radiation, as opposed to the scale that they've just announced, which measures the level of radioactive decay. And, of course, that's, in the case of Chernobyl, it was 5.2 million terabecquerels were released. And now the highest announced in Japan is 630,000 terabecquerels.
I'm not sure I agree with how the safety agency is representing the releases. I think there are other estimates, and I'm going to review all those estimates in the coming days. I haven't had a chance to review the Japanese safety agency's numbers and compare them to all the others that are out there. But that said, the two are related. The sieverts, which is a radiation dose, and the radiation releases are related. Radiation releases are like cobra venom. You know, it doesn't hurt you till it gets into your body, and sieverts are after the cobra bites you and the amount that got into your body. And so you can't get cobra venom into your body if it doesn't exist or if it hasn't been released. And so it's the greater the releases, and of course the releases have to intersect with food, water, air, and people, and land, and so on. And there has been deposition of radioactivity that's been very, very substantial in the environments of Fukushima. And of course, to a much lesser extent, there has been global fallout in the Northern Hemisphere, which has been measured here and in Europe.
Given there was a fundamental difference, Chernobyl was actually a working reactor that was in a state of fission when they foolishly allowed it to get out of control. This one, obviously we know what caused it, the earthquake and the subsequent tsunami that knocked out the backup power, knocked out the primary power and then the backup power. But the idea that they're somehow on a par, I think perhaps what's being lost here is that as terrible as it was to the Chernobyl accident was to the Ukraine and the vast area that's still uninhabitable, there's a lot of territory in the Ukraine.
Yes, exactly.
There's not much territory in Japan.
Well, there's that, and Chernobyl was one reactor, and there were no spent fuel pools that blew up. Here we have got three reactors and four spent fuel pools that are in question. So the total source of long-lived radioactivity like cesium-137, which would affect habitability questions, is very, very large. And this accident is not over. Chernobyl, the fire was put out after 10 days, and the reactor was sort of at least partially entombed in a preliminary way. This accident and the cooling that has to go on, this will have to go on for months. The spent fuel pools in three of the four reactors are exposed to the environment. It's unclear how they are going to clear out those spent fuel pools because the infrastructure, like the cranes and the service floors and all of that, has sustained enormous damage from the hydrogen explosions. So the problem of cooling the reactors and pools will go on for quite a long time. And I don't think the radiation releases, at least from spent fuel pools, 1, 3, and 4, especially 4, which has so much radioactivity, is going to be solved anytime soon.
Well, you know, Dr. Arjun Makhijani, there were reports of neutron radiation which would indicate criticality.
Yes. Now, we did publish a paper by a scientist who was visiting here in California, in Monterey, Ferenc Dalnoki-Veresh, and I reviewed his paper before we published it, and he did some calculations trying to estimate whether spontaneous fission, which occurs even in a shutdown reactor, could have been the cause of a detection of chlorine-38, which is a very short-lived isotope. And he concluded, I believe correctly, that it was not, that it would take a chain reaction producing lots of neutrons, an accidental chain reaction, after the reactor was shut, to produce that. Now, we don't, you know, TEPCO's measurements have been questionable, and they have been putting out measurements and then saying they are mistaken, and it's a company that doesn't have an entirely honorable record of being forthcoming with the public or even its regulators. So we don't know whether we can trust all these measurements. But if the measurement is right, I think that Ferenc is right, that an accidental criticality or perhaps more than one has occurred for short periods of time. These things tend to pulse in and out, and so they need to make more complete measurements. There'd be no follow-up measurements. There'd be no public statement about Ferenc's paper, which has received widespread attention in Japan. But we have no official word that such a thing has happened or not happened, or confirmatory measurements, which are not that hard to make.
So why do you think they're having such difficulty in cooling the spent fuel rods? 250 tons of it, by the way, in the pool at reactor number 4.
Well, I think looking at the pictures and the videos of the spent fuel, well, you can't see the spent fuel pool exactly from the videos and the pictures, but it's very clear that there is a lot of damage on the service floors, and I can't imagine that the pipes and the pumps and the pools themselves have not sustained a significant amount of damage. The fuel rods have sustained a significant amount of damage in spent fuel pools 3 and 4, at least.
Well, they dumped seawater, didn't they, from helicopters?
Yes, and they had to dump seawater. I'm not sure that there isn't some of the spent fuel that's lying on the reactor building floor or even, and there have been reports from the United States that some of the spent fuel was blown out of the reactor building and was found some distance away. There was a person who was found dead reportedly outside within the evacuation zone, and their body was discovered to be pretty radioactive and was not taken away, and this is not at the reactor site. Now, this is all from news reports, and, you know, the news kind of goes in and out, and we don't have very consistent information about what is going on there. But I am not confident at all that, in fact, I do believe that we're not getting the full story, and I don't know if they're making the measurements that would ever enable us to have the full story.
Well, in the last few minutes, Dr. Arjun Makhachani, clearly I've spoken to a former senior official in the Department of Energy who said that publicly the nuclear industry is putting on a brave face, but privately people are basically saying this is the death knell. And I'm wondering, I'm also hearing reports now that, oh, now thorium reactors will save us all, that there's a whole... there's a benign nuclear reactor that uses its own fuel. So where do you think the debate stands?
This is grasping at straws. People have been trying to do thorium reactors for 50 years, and we don't have one yet. Thorium has its own advantages and disadvantages, but the core problem with nuclear is the same. You're producing fissile materials in the course of operation just to boil water. You are producing fission products that are very, very long-lived. You're going to have a waste management problem that's very severe. In fact, I think some thorium reactors might have waste management problems that are quite as complicated or more complicated. A very, very small thorium reactor at Oak Ridge presented a mountain of decommissioning problems I'm not sure that, actually, I don't know the current status of that yet. But I know that for three decades, they're still talking about decommissioning. And this was a tiny, tiny reactor whose decommissioning estimates went up to $130 million for a reactor that never even generated any electricity. It was just a small pilot.
Well, I did an interview with somebody who touted thorium reactors, and I'm not going to bother playing the interview for the public.
Yeah,
I've made a decision right now, here and now. Well, thank you for joining us.
You can play it. You know, I encourage you to play it. There's room for public debate, but I think there are kind of cults around these reactors, and they don't see any of the plus and minuses. They only see the pluses, and this is what has gotten us into trouble, saying too cheap to meter, and this is going to solve our energy problem forever. And what it is people just want to perpetuate these esoteric jobs and making fissile materials just to boil water. And I think they're so firmly planted in the middle of the 20th century, it's frightening.
Well, I thank you for talking with us today, Arjun Makhachani.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Arjun Makhachani, who holds a doctorate in nuclear energy and is president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. His books include Nuclear Wastelands, Mending the Ozone Hole, and most recently, Carbon-Free and Nuclear-Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. We'll take a brief station break, and then we'll be back talking about the African Union's failed efforts in Libya. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Richard Downey, who is a Deputy Director and Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Program. Previously, he was a reporter and BBC journalist and worked in projects on Africa for the Council on Foreign Relations and the United States Institute of Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Downey.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
What do you make of the rather predictable rejection by the Libyan rebels of the African Union's proposals of a truce? Clearly, there's a visual contrast on television where you see the African Union delegates hugging Gaddafi, kisses all around, and down in Benghazi, the rebel stronghold, thousands of people outside are booing and hissing at them.
Right, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It was predictable that the rebels would reject this peace overture. Really, it was a non-starter, I think. The rebels after all, have one key demand, which is a prerequisite for any other negotiations. And of course, that's the departure of Gaddafi and his family members. So given that that was not part of the deal that the AU were trying to sell, it's therefore not surprising that they turned it down. And you're right to draw that contrast between the receptions that these AU representatives had in Tripoli and then out in the east. I think the rebels were very suspicious and wary of this proposal and thought that these guys were too close to Gaddafi.
So why did Jacob Zuma lead this delegation there in the first place?
Well, apparently he had other business to attend to, but it's interesting that upon departure, he described the mission as a great success. Well, I think the AU actually has been made to look a little bit naive in this whole episode. You know, first that they would take seriously anything that Gaddafi says. After all, you have to remember that he immediately agreed to their terms of peace, but then carried on bombing civilians in Misrata. Second, you know, the AU, if they honestly thought the rebels would accept a deal that didn't include Gaddafi's departure, then that was pretty naive as well, I think.
Well, I mean, the organization itself, which of course was formed in 1999 during an African summit hosted by Colonel Gaddafi, and of course he has been one of its biggest financial contributors from the outset. It is now the current AU president is Equatorial's Guinea's dictator, Teodoro Obiang, who we here in Los Angeles are graced with the presence of his son, who lives in the biggest mansion in Malibu, where he is has all kinds of Ferraris lined up and young women visiting around the clock. So how can we take this organization seriously, given that this rather psychotic kleptocrat is head of the AU?
You're right. It's not a great image to portray, is it, when you're an organization that is supposed to be standing up for good governance and democracy and the rights of not only African leaders, but African citizens in general, when it's led this year by one of the continent's just most unreformed dictators. I mean, someone like Obiang has no concept whatsoever of democracy, sees it as a completely foreign concept. So, the imaging is kind of jarring. That's right. But I do think on the plus side, the AU is trying to move in the right direction. It succeeded the Organization of African Unity, which was widely regarded as sort of dictator's club. At least the AU tries to launch peace missions, such as the ones you've seen in Libya, also in Cote d'Ivoire, to end the election crisis there. They talk of good governance. In fact, they have actually suspended African members who have fallen to military coups, such as Cote d'Ivoire and Mauritania not too long ago. So they are sort of making moves in the right direction, but it's slow progress. And as you say, there's still many hurdles to overcome.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Downey, Deputy Director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Program. Of course, Cote d'Ivoire has undergone the agony there was ended by the snatching of the intransigent leader who lost the election, which was apparently very fairly conducted. The AU didn't, because it was mostly the regional group, ECOWAS, that tried to reason with Gbagbo and get him to leave. And of course, we've witnessed a fairly hideous bloodletting in order to bring about some kind of truce. But it seems to me that in that case, there's been atrocities on both sides. How do you come down on that one, Richard?
Yeah, I think you're right. There have been atrocities committed by both sides in this conflict. The bulk of them clearly by Gbagbo, who, as you say, lost a free and fair election, lost it quite clearly. So I think in the end, it looks like we've turned the corner, and with Gbagbo's arrest, hopefully Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire can put these troubles behind them. Actually, in terms of the international response on this crisis, I would give the AU and the wider international community higher marks in at least that they were dedicated and committed to seeking a resolution right from the outset. They were quite unified. And eventually that pressure albeit military, in the end has paid off. And so, you know, I'm optimistic now that the country can move on and at least recover economically. But overcoming the political divisions that have fragmented the country for so long now will be a much more tricky prospect.
In a broader sense, where does the debate stand within Africa itself about its democratic future, given what's happening now with the so-called Arab Spring? There seems to be two schools of thought, that those who say, well, development first and then democracy will follow, and those that say, no, without democracy you'll never have development, you'll have what you have in so many cases, these kleptocratic thugs who hold on to power through the barrel of the gun.
Yeah, I think the debate is yet to be settled in Africa. We had a sort of a democratization process which looked pretty good about 10 years ago in the sort of late mid to late 90s and perhaps early 2000s. Well, things have plateaued a little bit more recently, and you're having this worrying trend in recent years where losing candidates such as Laurent Gbagbo in Ivory Coast turn around and reject the outcome of elections. And I think this is actually a bad thing for the democratic process and legitimacy of elections in Africa. Of course, many of these losing candidates, Gbagbo aside, had good reason to claim that they were falsely denied victory. But, you know, each time this happens, and you've seen it in several elections this year alone, it kind of degrades the process and causes the electorate themselves to lose faith in democracy. So I think that's one of the big issues right now. And we've got some very critical elections going on in Nigeria right now and other countries later this year. So I think it's very important that we keep an eye on these elections and hope that they go more smoothly.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Downey, Deputy Director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Program. Let's just return to Libya, if we can, here, because this peace deal was a phony to begin with, and its rejection was predictable. However, there is apparently a stalemate, and you have this kind of Mad Max army on the part of the rebels that is clearly not coordinated with NATO. And NATO itself, having lost the United States, appears to be floundering. So do you see this heading towards a very unsatisfactory stalemate and possibly a division of this country?
Well, I think we are in a situation of stalemate, at least militarily, on the ground right now. And it's hard to see a way out of this impasse at the moment. And so, therefore, I think you are going to see more peace initiatives going forward now. Although the AU one wasn't very successful, there's going to be more to come. And I think that both warring sides are going to have to become a little bit more flexible because at the moment their demands just cannot be bridged. On the battlefield, the rebels, you're right, there's just no sign that they're going to be able to force the issue militarily anytime soon. They're still disorganized. They're desperate for training and equipment and weapons. Even if they do receive training, it's going to take several months for the effect to kick in and for them to make advances. Gaddafi, meanwhile, I think feels fairly secure. He's playing the international community at their own game, and he seems on top at the moment, I think. His military capability is obviously being degraded by this NATO campaign, but the NATO campaign is fairly limited in scope. So at the moment, I can't see the rebels capitalizing.
And what do you make of Moussa Koussa's defection, if that's what it was, the foreign minister, former intelligence chief? He's gone to London, now he's gone to Qatar. Qatar, of course, is the only Arab country yet to join in with NATO. What do you think's going on there?
It's been an interesting few days, and there's been much debate about the significance of Moussa Koussa's defection. Formerly very, very close to Gaddafi, was his intelligence chief at large for many, many years, really the sort of the man that was at his side, but was sidelined somewhat in the latter couple of years. So I think Gaddafi is sort of shrugging this defection off. The key people now are his current military and intelligence chiefs, and of course his immediate family members. So until as long as they're loyal and around him, I think Gaddafi will feel fairly secure and won't be losing much sleep about Muzakusa's disappearance.
And to the uncomfortable subject of racism in Africa, I was surprised. I host the UCLA Hammer Forum here in Los Angeles and did a forum recently on Sudan with representatives from the North and the South and a UCLA anthropologist who spent 50 years studying the country, which is, as you know, is splitting in two. And there's history of genocide and likely to be more genocidal activities. And what came out of that conference was this notion that much of the struggle is driven by racism, by the Arab North's racist attitude to the African South. And how much is racism a part of what's going on in Libya? Because Gaddafi has made an arrangement, or one of his sons, with the military in Chad. We heard earlier from the beginning of the military struggle, when the rebels were riding high and then were driven back largely by African mercenaries, it was alleged. So give us a sense of what's going on there in terms of, or as an Africanist, have you detected this Arab versus African racism?
Yeah, the Arab versus African dynamic is at play across this region. You're right. It was a key dynamic in the civil war between North and South Sudan. And it's an element, I think, in this conflict as well, and particularly around the debate about, these foreign mercenaries who the rebels are accusing of kind of propping up Gaddafi and keeping him in power. I think, they're too quick, the rebels, to blame foreigners, and by foreigners they mean sort of black Africans, sub-Saharan Africans. These are the mercenaries, they say, who are committing the most egregious human rights abuses on behalf of the Gaddafi regime. And it's very hard to kind of judge and gauge what's going on and how significant they are in numbers. I think there's a sense that as a conflict unfolds, it becomes easy to blame foreigners or Africans for all the problems of the country, and I don't think that's actually an accurate depiction of what's going on. It's clear that Gaddafi has more important sources of support than foreign mercenaries, not least among tribal followers and elements of his own military forces, which I think are much more important in deciding this crisis.
Well, apparently there's some Gaddafi's son, not Hamis, the other one, has apparently hired Belarusian special forces.
Right, exactly. The reports of mercenaries aren't just African mercenaries we're talking about. We've had all kinds of countries sort of thrown into the mix, Syria, Serbia, Ukraine, and Belarus, as you say. It's kind of hard to back up some of these reports, but it's clear that Gaddafi is very resourceful. He still has deep pockets despite the current crisis, and is able to attract mercenaries from many countries beyond the African continent.
So just returning for a moment, if we can, Richard Downey, to this division in Africa between those who advocate development first and democracy will follow, and democracy first. What role is China playing in that? Because they're not great champions of democracy, as you know, but they're also active in development in Africa.
Right, yeah, the influence of China is felt very, very strongly across the African continent. And of course, many African leaders, many of the less democratic ones, much prefer dealing with China. They don't receive lectures on human rights. China has a strictly business approach. And African leaders like dealing with them. Chinese workers and the Chinese governments provide them with the kinds of things they need, infrastructure, roads and schools, the old presidential palace as well. So the Chinese involvement is a good thing in the minds of many African leaders. But you're right, this does play into this debate about what does Africa need most of all, development or democracy. And I just think that's a false distinction, even though it's claimed by African leaders. You have Paul Kagame in Rwanda, for example, who has touted the economic success of the country and its ability to reconstruct after the genocide of 94. and using that as an excuse to sort of tamp down dissent and really block any kind of political opposition from emerging. I just think that's a short-term and short-sighted strategy. People, of course, want to put food on the table and they want schools to go to, but ultimately that's not going to be enough if they don't have political freedoms as well.
How do you explain this anomaly of Zimbabwe, where you have neither democracy nor development?
Well, I think the story of democracy is in Zimbabwe. It's a story of one ruthless dictator who's determined to just cling on to power for himself and his cronies and enrich himself. Mugabe has always been a dictator. He's never been committed to democracy. And he doesn't really mind what he does to keep in power. And if that includes impoverishing his people, then so be it. And unfortunately, Africa has a few of these types of characters, and I hope we see the back of them soon.
Well, just in closing in the last minute then, Richard Downey, in terms of democracy, what's your takeaway from the Nigerian election?
Well, it remains to be seen at the moment. It's early days. We've just had the first weekend where we had the National Assembly elections. And so far, we can be cautiously optimistic, I think. They seem to be fairly credible. Not many reported instances of violence and voter intimidation. The opposition party seem to have made fairly strong gains. So far, so good, according to the international monitors and local monitors, for that matter. The crux, though, will be this coming weekend when we have the main event, the presidential election. So all eyes will be on what happens this weekend, and we just hope that Nigeria can pull off a better election than it had back in 2007.
Well, thank you for talking with us today, Richard Downey.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Downey, who's a Deputy Director and Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa program. Previously, he worked for the BBC as a journalist in Africa and worked on African projects with the Council on Foreign Relations and the United States Institute of Peace. We're going to take a brief station break now and be back talking about the connections between African dictators like the deposed Gbagbo and Christian Wright in Washington on C Street. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Justin Elliott, who is a reporter for Salon.com, where he has been following the ties between the Christian Wright and Ivory Coast's recently deposed dictator Laurent Gbagbo. He previously was a news editor at Talking Points Memo and a reporter at TPM Muckraker. Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Elliott.
Hi, good to be here.
And you've been onto this story. The New York Times picked it up today. What is, again, the ubiquitous C Street comes up. What is the connections there between this kind of dormitory of right-wing politicians, Senator Jim Imhoff among them, John Ensign, who had some troubles with his marriage, etc., and, of course, the famous Appalachian Trail governor? I can't help being facetious, I'm sorry. What is the to your mind, the most flagrant connection between this recently deposed Gbagbo and the Christian Wright?
Well, yeah, I mean, as you said, C Street plays a role. It's a little bit of a complicated network of connections, but I'll give you a taste of it, which is the organization that runs the C Street House that you referred to, which is a house in Washington in which several conservative members of Congress live together and sort of get spiritual guidance together. It's run by an organization called The Family, also known as The Fellowship, which is sort of a evangelical Christian organization that's been in Washington for many decades now that tries to give sort of spiritual guidance with a right-leaning, or more than right-leaning, definite right-wing tilt to people in positions of power, both in the United States and abroad. So James Inhofe, the senator from Oklahoma, Republican senator from Oklahoma, is sort of an active member, or at least he has close ties to the leadership of this organization called The Fellowship. They also run a big annual event called the National Prayer Breakfast, at which a lot of these politicians and politicians from abroad come to Washington and sort of meet and talk about various policy matters and religious matters. So bringing it back to Côte d'Ivoire, the recently, as of this week, deposed leader, Laurent Gbagbo, and his wife, Simone, are both evangelical Christians who have actually traveled to Washington in years past and attended this national prayer breakfast. So Inhofe knows them through that. He also knows them through his extensive travels in Africa, which included stops in Côte d'Ivoire. And so now Inhofe has sort of become the American champion of Laurent Gbagbo.
And, of course, both Ouattara, who won the election, and Gbagbo, who lost the election and refused to step down, and this was an internationally monitored election that was fair by all accounts, they both have been accused of atrocities against innocent civilians. How do these so-called Christians in Washington justify that kind of atrocity? And at the same time, this fellow is a Christian. They share Christian fellowship with this fellow Gbagbo and his wife Simone.
That's right. I mean, well, first of all, I mean, people like Senator Inhofe, as well as Pat Robertson, who's also been a vocal Gbagbo supporter, they don't really justify the atrocities on Gbagbo's side because they basically deny they've happened. I mean, they've been very tendentious about the entire situation and basically just been repeating Gbagbo's line. Inhofe and Robertson have both claimed that the election was stolen, which is what Gbagbo has said. But on the other side of it, you know, the United Nations, the African Union, basically everyone else in the world besides Gbagbo have said that he lost the election fair, the November election fair and square by 6 or 7 points. Now, the tragedy of the whole situation is after the election in November, which, as I said, everyone outside of Gbagbo says that Gbagbo lost to his opponent, Ouattara, there was violence started soon after that, but it didn't escalate for a couple of months. And there were sort of there were efforts by the United States sort of behind the scenes to try to get Gbagbo to leave peacefully, to give him some sort of sinecure position in the U.S. or at some international organization. And
By the way, Justin, sorry to interrupt you, Justin, yeah. But the President Obama apparently offered Gbagbo a history professorship at an unnamed university in Boston.
That's right. Actually, it was, I can tell you, it was Boston University. And they have a Center for African Studies or something like that at Boston University. And what the State Department was trying to do behind the scenes, and I wrote about this at Salon.com, was because the State Department knew that Senator Inhofe was friends with Gbagbo, both from this National Prayer Breakfast and from Inhofe's own missionary work in Côte d'Ivoire, the State Department actually approached Inhofe earlier this year, around the turn of the year, when the crisis was still in a much earlier and less violent stage, and asked him to approach Gbagbo and to offer and entice him into taking this BU position and in that way to, you know, defuse the crisis. Now, Inhofe refused to do this. He refused to even approach Gbagbo. And then, you know, 6 weeks later, Inhofe came out publicly and said, look, this election was a fraud. Gbagbo won it. The Obama administration and the entire international community is wrong about this. And really, as we've just talked about, the roots of that support for Gbagbo from Inhofe, who, by the way, is basically the leading Republican on African affairs in the U.S. Senate. The roots
and also the leading denier of global warming in the U.S. government,
yeah,
I think.
That's right as well. I mean, he's the leading many things. But in this particular case, the Republican caucus in the Senate tends to defer to Inhofe on all sorts of African affairs policy questions. So he's very influential. And in this case, it seems to have been in large part these sort of religious ties between him and the Gbagbos that led him to take this sort of very unhelpful position.
But again, I'm speaking with Justin Elliott, who's a reporter for Salon.com, who broke the story about these ties between the Christian right and this brutal despot in Africa who's just been deposed. along with his wife, a front page picture in today's New York Times, showing them looking a little uncomfortable, I would say. Now, and of course, they're in the hands of Ouattara, the guy that won the election. He has been vilified by Pat Robinson, who only last Tuesday on the 700 Club referred to the fact that Ouattara is a Muslim, referred to this notion that this is all to do with a Muslim building a ring of Sharia law around the Middle East. And that has also been echoed by Glenn Beck on Fox. What are they talking about?
Well, I mean, I think I think it's fair to say that Pat Robertson doesn't really know what he's talking about. But I mean, I think it is an interesting part of the dynamic here, which is part of what's going on in Cote d'Ivoire is that there is this Christian Muslim sectarian split that explains some of the politics there. And for sort of Christian rights figures in the U.S., that's a very appealing dynamic to exploit, and that fits very comfortably into their worldview. So as you said, you have Pat Robertson and his television network, the Christian Broadcasting Network, CBN. For several months now, they've been covering this Cote d'Ivoire situation in an extremely tendentious way, entirely as Gbagbo partisans. They actually sent a reporter there to interview Gbagbo. This is still pretty early on, but while Gbagbo's forces were committing atrocities, according to various human rights organizations, and Pat Robertson's network was comparing the situation to the Bush versus Gore election in 2000, in which Gbagbo was playing the role of Bush and Ouattara was playing the role of Gore, and they were saying, you know, imagine if Gore refused to concede the election. That was like the Pat Robertson view of this situation. But I will say one other thing, and in some ways it's a larger story here, which is that Jim Inhofe, for about 15 years now, has been traveling to Africa on taxpayers' money, on sort of quasi-official trips. And on these official trips to places, including Cote d'Ivoire, he does missionary work. And he's fairly open about talking about this, but he's mixing his work as a U.S. senator with Christian missionary work, and he goes to Africa several times a year, and he has been for the last 15 years. It's something that I think deserves probably more attention than it's gotten.
And has he been in, and of course it's sort of, obviously it's an unintentional irony, but the idea that these people like Imhoff and Robertson support Gbagbo and make an analogy with Bush v. Gore and the Florida election, and of course Gore being the poster boy for global warming, which Imhoff opposes. But has Imhoff and the others, have they been involved in Uganda as well, where we know there have been connections between some people from C Street and these homophobic politicians in Uganda, where, of course, recently an openly gay fellow called David Kato was killed. And he was a brave Ugandan who spoke out at a conference and embarrassed everybody by admitting he was gay, which was a taboo subject, and he was bludgeoned to death in his home. Of course, the police are referring to it as a robbery, but clearly there are suspicious circumstances. So,
Inhofe has certainly been to Uganda, and we do know, as you said, that the this right-wing Christian organization called the Fellowship, which runs C Street, has certainly been very active in Uganda. I believe they have been promoting a Ugandan version of the National Prayer Breakfast there, and there have been there are ties between the Fellowship and the political forces in Uganda that are pushing this legislation that a lot of people have probably heard of that would make committing homosexual acts a crime that gets the death penalty. That hasn't actually passed in Uganda, but it's something that I believe is still being pushed.
Well, that's what David Kato was speaking out against, the anti-homosexuality bill that would impose life imprisonment for gay sexual activity or even a death penalty in some cases.
Exactly. And I'm not sure about the specifics of Inhofe's work in Uganda, besides the fact that he's been there. I mean, he has his hand in a lot of the politics of these African countries, and he has sort of a very skewed and very specific perspective on what's going on there. But we do know that the fellowship has been very active in Uganda, and in fact, they've taken a very particular sort of missionary interest in Africa for decades now. So there's definitely all of this deserves more scrutiny probably than it's getting in the media right now.
So these people hate gays, hate environmentalists, and hate obviously they hate homosexuals. They hate Muslims, but. What on the other side? What is it? They love God. I mean, what is it that they are bringing to the table here, to Africans? Because in the case of Gbagbo, when he was under siege, his own Christian ministers were saying that only God could remove him from power. Perhaps that explains his intransigence.
Right. I mean, it certainly may. I mean, both Gbagbo and his wife Simone, who is sort of seen as a very influential figure there in Cote d'Ivoire. She's a politician in her own right and influential with her husband. They're both known for lacing their speeches with a lot of sort of religious rhetoric and invoking God, invoking, you know, saying essentially that God is on their side and all that sort of thing. And I mean, again, that's the same sort of rhetoric that you've seen from people like Pat Robertson, who are saying that Gbagbo is basically a nice guy. He ran a pretty good shop. He deserves the support of the United States. In terms of Inhofe, he has there was an excellent article that people should read from a few years ago in his hometown newspaper, the Oklahoman, sort of taking a close look at these missionary / political trips he takes to Africa. And he told the reporter for that story that he described the trips to Africa as, quote, a Jesus thing. So he likes to go in and pray with as many leaders of these countries as possible. And that's where the ties between him and many of these Christian leaders come from, like Gbagbo. And so the policy implications of these connections we can see right now, where he is just standing by his man, essentially, regardless of the evidence about the election, regardless of independent reports from groups like Human Rights Watch about Gbagbo's forces, especially early on, committing atrocities against civilians. As you said, it is important to note that there have definitely been atrocities reported on both sides at this point, but right. It started, it's fair to say, with Gbagbo's forces. Clearly, the religious stuff is an important undertone of the politics here.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Justin Elliott.
Thanks a lot.
Again, I've been speaking with Justin Elliott, who's a reporter for Salon.com. He previously was a news editor at Talking Points Memo and a reporter at TPM Muckraker. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. If you heard something you like, something you don't like, any suggestions or tips, let us know. We read every email. You can also check out my blog. Go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. I'll be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.